So Nigel was supposed to be preaching today, and he was going to speak on the story of Jesus being led by the Holy Spirit into the wilderness, where he confronted Satan on all of our behalf. And I want us to keep that story in mind, but since Nigel's not here, I get to do whatever I want. And so we're going to hear the gospel lesson, but at the end of the sermon. And, you know, you get these ideas, and if you don't have much time to think on them, they seem like a great idea. We'll see if this is a bad idea or not. Let's keep in mind the story of Jesus defeating Satan. And then he begins his ministry, showing in both the authority with which he teaches, but also in his ministry to people, that he is not encumbered by the power of Satan at all. And the first thing that he does is gathers the people that have begun to follow him, and he sits down and he begins to teach in Matthew what is called the Sermon on the Mount. Now, we looked at the opening passages a few weeks ago, and today I want to look at the first of the teachings that Jesus gives. So last 2 weeks ago, we looked at the context, and Jesus begins with a third-person address to those who are out there, and that's how he ends as well, in the third person. And then he moves into a second-person direct teaching to his disciples. So you see there's a mirror going on. If we get closer next week, or in 2 weeks, we'll see that he says, there's a mirror as well, where he says, don't be like the play actors when you fast. Don't be like the play actors, the hypocrites, when you pray or when you give. And then if we go right to the very center, it's the Lord's Prayer. It's the center of all of this teaching. We want to be careful that he gives us a context before giving us direct instructions. The context is crucial. And at the center is prayer, a real relationship with God. No phoniness, no pretending. That's at the center of all the teaching. That is one of the things we keep in mind so that we do not fall into play acting, into legalism, into using laws as a weapon. What Jesus teaches here in the section that we'll hear is taking the prohibitions that you may have heard, and then he adds often a prohibition of his own, a further, deeper, harder prohibition. And so there are straightforward instructions, which is, for some people, exactly what we want. Just tell me what it is I'm supposed to do. But when you take Jesus' teaching, sometimes he puts it positively, not just a prohibition, but here's what we're after. Here's what God is after. And sometimes we have to do that work ourselves. What is it God is after for humanity? Jesus in this teaching is pointing us to have a picture of a good life. That's something we are striving for. The prohibitions are meant to keep us on track, to at least, the very least, keep us from the worst and most egregious breaking of the rules. But they're also there to point us in the right direction so that we might begin to reach out for the goal for which we've been called in Jesus Christ. He is pointing us towards a good life, one that we might aspire to, a life of real relationships with one another, of real relationships with God, a good life in which you see every person you encounter as worthy of love. I might even say as lovable. Let's go through the ones that Jesus outlines, that Jesus will teach us. You have heard it was said, do not murder. But I tell you that you are answerable for being angry. So there is the prohibition of murder from the Old Testament, but Jesus deepens that and says, but you are not even to be angry with someone else. As John will tell us in his letter, anger was what led to hate and murder. And so Jesus does the work for us, and he puts it positively as well. There's not just the prohibition of anger, there's also, what is it we are aiming for? And how do we live that out? He says, if you know someone has something against you, go and quickly come to terms. And the Greek here, where's Annabelle? The word is going to let me down. I shouldn't write it down in Greek. But a more faithful translation would be to say, go and make friends with them quickly. That is literally what the word means. Presumably what's going on and how it's used in other contexts, this is the only time this word is used in the New Testament, is that in order to be friends with someone who's got something against you, you've got to come to terms. There has to be restitution. There has to be reconciliation. But the goal is, go and become friends quickly. Jesus moves on. You have heard it was said, do not to have affairs with your neighbors. Specifically, this is aimed at men. Not surprisingly, unfortunately. Aimed at men, and their prohibition is against adultery. But Jesus' prohibition goes even deeper. Do not even look at other people with desire. And what are we talking about here? The longer looks that we give some people, a second look, maybe even nudging a friend, suggesting they look, perhaps even daydreaming later. And Jesus here goes on to prohibit similarly divorce. How would we put these positively? That in our marriage and in our interactions with people who are not our spouses, that we are not to treat people as a means to meet our own personal appetites. In terms of divorce, there was spelled out at the time reasons for which a husband, who was the only one who had the right to divorce, could divorce his wife. And it was for standards not being met, even in cooking, as the famous example that's trotted out to show just the state of things at the time. If your wife burnt your toast, you could send her away in divorce. I don't know if Lorna, have you burnt Pete's toast before? As I was saying? And yet, there he is. What a good man. Still, you make your own now. Oh, yeah. But in terms of lust and the second looks that we give to people, Jesus, to put it positively, is that we aren't to look at somebody else and how they might gratify us, but that we might recognize them as their own people, with their own needs, their own wants and desires, with their own will, with their own calling on their own life. Presumably what's involved as well is that we would treat our spouse and everyone we meet with respect. That we would be willing to put them first and their needs first and to serve them. Jesus moves from the promise of marriage to the promise in general, to oaths in general. And he says it has been prohibited breaking your oaths made to God. But his prohibition is don't swear oaths at all. Again, to put it positively, as Jesus does, is if only say you can, you will do it, if you can and will do it. And otherwise, say no. And this one takes maybe a little bit more thought, or at least it did for me, and I had to actually get other people's advice. That we don't use oaths very seriously anymore. But one commentator said, but have you ever been in a conversation where you or someone else has said, look, I promise to do whatever? When we say that, I promise, in our culture, part of what's going on there is, I think, trying to convince someone to do something, trying to get them to commit or to agree with you. So there's a sense in which when we say, I promise, that we are doing something manipulative. We are perhaps also wanting to please people. which is in its own way manipulative. Perhaps we are overestimating our own ability or our own importance, and we want to be able to meet people's needs, and so we say, I will do this. When, if we were honest with ourselves and real with the other people, we would say, I don't think I can do this right now. I don't think I have that ability, or the time, the means. So there's an element of self-deception as well as manipulation. How might we put this prohibition positively? Be honest with yourself. Can you keep your word here? Be real with the person you are speaking to, not manipulative. Open and free and letting them decide their own mind without any pressure. The next prohibition is a well-known one from the Old Testament. An eye for an eye. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And before we can talk about it, there's two things that we have to say about it because it's so misunderstood. This wasn't a law meant to maximize the punishment inflicted on a perpetrator. It was just the opposite. These were ancient guidelines designed to restore relationship through restitution. These were ancient laws that restricted escalation. So if someone injured you in some way, you couldn't escalate it and get them back for even more than what you had suffered. And secondly, it was never likely meant to be taken literally, or never used literally. That if someone actually lost an eye, then they would then have the right to gouge out the other person's eye. And as soon as we have commentaries, ancient commentaries on these passages, we see very quickly that there is an exchange expected of we would say cash today, but of value of some kind. So an eye had a value, or an injured animal had a value, and there was the goal was to exchange something of value to restore relationship. But Jesus doesn't use a prohibition here, but instead asks for something even deeper as we look for restitution. And he says famously, turn the other cheek, go the extra mile, and give the shirt off your own back. In each case, instead of fighting back, instead of restitution, aiming for restitution reconciliation through restitution, Jesus is suggesting a creative and disarming act on the part of the victim that will unsettle and destabilize and shock and surprise the perpetrator. And perhaps we would say the strategy here is to de-escalate the situation and to help the aggressor see the victim in a new light. These are practices that will force the aggressor to see the victim's agency, their personal choice being used not for restitution, not for getting even, but agency used for grace and mercy. And there is a chance here, a chance that the perpetrator will see the other person not as an opponent and not as someone beneath them, but as a fellow human being who has used their will to do something loving and gracious. Jesus says, turn the other cheek, and some commentators suggest that, you know, this is a backhanded slap on the left cheek, and it's turn the other one to force the person to look you in the eye and to hit you as an equal. Are you really going to do this? Look me in the eye and see. I'm flesh and blood like you. There's something more available to us than this conflict. To go the extra mile, where Roman soldiers had the right to take any of the people in Jerusalem and load their packs on their back and force them, regardless of what they were doing, and say, you are to carry this for a mile for me. That was the law. And Jesus says, go the extra mile. Maybe getting that Roman soldier to see that this was a person with their own will and of their own free choice is willing to carry your pack further and giving the shirt off your back. For us, it would be like surrendering your winter coat in the winter. Appalling that someone who was in debt would be forced to surrender their winter coat or forced to surrender any clothes, but then volitionally of their own will said, well, here's my winter coat, take it. Shocking. And we would hope in that moment that the person who was trying to take the clothes to pay off a debt would see, would be shocked into saying, well, I can't take the only thing that keeps you alive from you. No, let's work things out in some other way. To this, Jesus adds another call, another positive suggestion. Give to those in need. Loan to those in need. And so what I'm trying to suggest, and what others have pointed out, is the overall pattern of this section is that there is this overall pattern in this section of Jesus' teaching, and it's underlined in the very last statement or teaching that Jesus gives. And he says, you have heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, certainly Leviticus does say, love your neighbor. But later teachers did actually add, and Jewish commentators, and you can hate your enemies. But Jesus puts it positively. No, love your enemies. Pray for your enemies. If we are to pray for someone, we have to do what I did with Robin and Peter. Tell me about yourself. Tell me, how can we be praying for you? We have to begin to hear those words and imagine them as fellow human beings before God. Jesus is here, once again, getting us to be real with one another, to see one another as fellow human beings. Every person, our spouse, our neighbors, the people that we might be tempted to treat as just sexual objects, the people that we might be tempted to treat as people who owe us something, even our enemies, to see all of them as fellow human beings. The prohibitions are just a starting point. Jesus is certainly trying to give us guidelines. Don't cross these lines, at least. But he's trying to give us new habits so that they might become instinctive habits, so that they might change our very character and heart. He gave us these practices to help perpetrators stop doing what they are doing and to see their victims for the first time in all of their humanity. And likewise, for victims to see the perpetrators as fellow human beings as well. And he gives us creative opportunities to go and quickly make friends with them. But a word about treating these as rules and laws. Jesus is not just trying to replace old rules with even harder rules. He is trying to make it clear just how much each one of us has to address in our own hearts and in our own minds. This whole section of teaching starts with Jesus saying, I haven't come to abolish the law. I have come to fulfill it to bring it to its full purpose. And the end of this section, he says something also hard for us to get our heads around. Be perfect, as our Father in heaven is perfect. Now, in our modern English, perfect means what? Without flaws? Without blemish? Without error? Now, everyone who comments on this passage agrees. There's got to be a better word than this. This isn't the idea. But no one seems to have found a better one. In the Greek, it's teleos. It's related to the word telos, which you may recognize from teleology, the study of end times, end things. The idea is that there's an end. There's a purpose. There's a goal. that humanity is called toward. And we would say it's been revealed in Jesus Christ. He is the end. He is the goal. He is what a whole human being looks like. He is what a completed human being looks like. And we are endeavoring to become that in our lives. We are endeavoring to become perfect in that way. Whole, complete, finished. In 1 Corinthians, in a famous passage, Paul uses this same word, and maybe it helps illustrate the difference. Paul says in the passage on love, you know the one, love is patient, love is kind. Paul says, we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will end. And here Paul is using the contrast of something we have only in part, but there's a fullness, there's a wholeness, there's a completeness that is still coming. And that is true for us as human beings. We see each other partial, incomplete, but we are all, every single human being, moving toward a time, thanks to Jesus Christ and the work of the Holy Spirit, toward a time when we will be whole and complete. And so Jesus is trying to give us a picture of that goal that we are moving towards. There's the base prohibition, but he wants us to see what we're aiming for. This is God's purpose. This is Jesus' purpose. It's why he set us free from the devil, so that we might begin to walk towards that wholeness of life. As John says in 1 John, that we might become children of God. But the temptation is to fall back on legalism. We're tempted to make life a test. And if you pass or fail. But Jesus, I think, is describing life as a journey that is formative. And we have the opportunity, thanks to his teaching, to recognize that each one of us is on that journey. All the people we encounter that drive us crazy, who dilly-dally in the line when we're in a rush and don't move with the red when the light turns green, they're in a formative journey. We're in a formative journey. The people who have affairs are in a formative journey. The people who take advantage of us and take more money than they should are in a formative journey. And we are in that formative journey. It's a dilemma for us, especially in the modern West. Part of our freedom as Canadians in general is that, and I quote, everything which is not forbidden is allowed. Our approach to laws and order in the West is that everything in morality gets reduced down to a question of law. In schoolyard language, it's a free country. It's legal. Alexander Solzhenitsyn observed this of the Western culture, that we reduce everything, morality, spiritually, down to questions about what the law says. It's legal. But if we memorize the criminal code and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and all the sorts of laws that we have, criminal, corporate, traffic, tax laws, and so on and on, with the goal of not breaking them, likely you would stay out of trouble. But will it help you become a better person? Will it help you reach the goal to which you have been called in Jesus Christ? We describe some people as law-abiding citizens. We don't mean that they know all the laws or that they've memorized them. We're trying to capture something else there. That there's something about their character. Respect, integrity, honesty, compassion, trying to live a good life. Somehow what we mean, we capture this sense that it's not about the laws. The laws are there just as a bare minimum. But rather we have a sense when we say law-abiding citizen that we are called to something far greater as human beings. There is a good that we know we are called to. The law tells us these days that in a school zone, you have to slow down to 30 during the day. But if you're in a zone where it's 100 or 70, and you see children playing by the side of the road, what do you do? Well, the law says I can do this other speed. But the 30 kilometers an hour is there to help you instinctively slow down when you see children. You do it in every school zone so that when you see children, you naturally then will say, well, I need to slow right down because who knows what those kids are going to do next. And nothing is more important. Nothing's so important in my life right now that I shouldn't slow down. The law is not the goal, even in Canadian law. It's there to shape us and to push us in a direction of a good life. As we reflect on the rest of Jesus' teachings, they are meant to encourage us to be honest and truthful with ourselves and with God and with others. And I can say honestly that I should have timed this out. That we should treat ourselves and others that they have a goal in life. God has called us and is transforming us into sons and daughters, and every other person, we ought to see them in this light.